Again, for those of you who have just joined us, welcome to today's webinar. And it's hosted by the National Center for the Review and Prevention of Child Deaths and the Children's Safety Network. I'm delighted to report we have 1,300 people registered for the webinar, and we're going to get started in just a minute. Today we are fortunate to have Carrie Shapiro Mendoza, Lena Camperlingo, Terry Covington, Lindsay Myers, Michael Goodstein, and Judy Bannon with us. And if you, this is the overview slide that will describe what we're going to be speaking about today. And if you go to the next slide, you'll see our presenters and you'll see their pictures and a little bit about them, their title. Bailey, if you could please unmute Carrie's line, we'll get started. Now, Carrie and Lena are joining us from Atlanta at the CDC. Okay, Carrie, please go ahead.
Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Dr. Carrie Shapiro Mendoza, and I'm here with my colleague, Lena Camperlingo. I will begin, and what I'm going to talk to you about today is understanding SUID. I'm going to discuss some definitions, trends, and then Lena will tell you about the SUID case registry. So, again, I just told you this, I'll go over definitions of SIDS and other SUID, trends in SIDS and other SUID mortality. I'll talk about SUID surveillance and death certificates, and then we'll discuss CDC's SUID case registry pilot program. SUID definition. You'll hear different things from different people, and I'm sure everyone out in the audience has their own definition of SUID or SUDI or whatever. When I'm talking about SUID, and when we're talking about it here at CDC, what we're referring to is sudden, unexpected infant death. And these are infant deaths that occur suddenly and unexpectedly in previously healthy infants. There was no immediately obvious cause of death prior to investigation. These were unexplained deaths at the time. And it excludes deaths with an obvious cause, such as motor vehicle accidents. And SIDS, sudden infant death syndrome, is one type of SUID. So there are other types of SUID. I mentioned SIDS. There's accidental suffocation. There's deaths that are just called undetermined. There's deaths that, you know, at the time, you know, when the death was occurred, it couldn't be explained, but when they did further investigation, they found it was infections or inborn errors in metabolism, cardiac channelopathies. So there are several different types of SUID. We think of SUID here as explained, and then those that are unexplained, and unexplained in the sense that unexplained by autopsy or that an autopsy wasn't completed. And the explained deaths are those like long QT syndrome, the metabolic disorders such as MCAD, head injuries, homicides, hyperthermias, infections, overdose. And then there's the unexplained deaths. And we categorize them as unexplained because they can often be confused with one another or people have different definitions and call it different things. But these unexplained deaths or unexplained by autopsy are SIDS, undetermined cause, and suffocation. And we'll talk a little bit more about them in a minute. So SIDS, sudden infant death syndrome. We use here at CDC the definition that was coined in 1991 by a National Institute of Health work group that was led by Marion Willinger. And it's the sudden death of an infant under 1 year of age, which remains unexplained after a thorough case investigation. And a thorough case investigation means that there was a performance of a complete autopsy, an examination of the death scene, and a review of the infant's clinical history or medical history. Now, when we talk about suffocation, I'm referring to accidental suffocation and strangulation in bed. And these, when we're trying to monitor or do surveillance of accidental suffocation, we use an ICD code of W75. But what this code includes are several different mechanisms. So when you hear accidental suffocation and strangulation in bed in ASSB, it includes several of these mechanisms. So first, there's suffocation by soft bedding, a pillow, or waterbed mattress. There's overlaying, so somebody rolls on top of or against a baby while sleeping. The baby could become wedged or entrapped between a mattress and a wall and a bed frame, so that's a third type of mechanism. And then there's finally strangulation. The infant's head and neck are caught between the crib railings. So when you're looking at national data using death certificates, and they've looked at accidental suffocation, strangulation, and BED, which are these codes, W75. It could be any one of these different mechanisms. It's really, there's no way with this code that you can distinguish between an overlay death and a suffocation death by soft bedding. So I'm going to tell you now a little bit about trends in SIDS and these other types of SUID. There's about 4,600 SUID deaths per year, and about half of these, about 2,300, are SIDS deaths. So the most frequently reported causes of SUID are SIDS, and SIDS is the leading cause of post-neonatal mortality. That's after the first month of life up until the first year, and it's the third leading cause of overall infant mortality. It's unknown. Another frequently reported cause, about 2,000 cases a year, are unknown or undetermined cause. And then the next most frequently reported type of SUID is accidental suffocation and strangulation in bed, like I was just telling you about in the last slide. And this type of death is the leading cause of infant injury mortality. And these deaths, because they're a type of injury, are potentially preventable. And that's specifically the accidental suffocation and strangulation in bed. There's some other less reported causes of sudden unexpected infant death, and these can include infanticide, inborn errors in metabolism, and cardiac channelopathies. This slide's a little bit complicated, but I'm going to walk you through it. It's looking at the U.S. SUID-specific infant mortality rates from the year 1990 to 2007. So if you look on the x-axis, you have the years, and it goes from 1990 to 2007. On the y-axis, you have the number of deaths per every 100,000 births. The red line is your SIDS line. The yellow line are those deaths that were called cause unknown. And the green line at the very bottom are those accidental suffocations and strangulation in bed. And then that light blue line on the top is combining all of those and looking at the rates. So when you first look at the SIDS line, the red line up at the top, you see that in 1990, it accounted for about 130 per 100,000 infant deaths. And then you see throughout the 90s, there was a dramatic decline by more than 50% of SIDS up until about 2001. And then, you know, rates have pretty much stayed stable, haven't really fluctuated much. What you can't see as much is if you look at the green and the yellow line for the accidental suffocation deaths and the unknown deaths, things were fairly stable in the 1990s. And there's a lot fewer of these deaths, but they did begin to creep up a little bit more after the year 2000. And when you look at the combined line, that light blue line, what you see is it follows the SIDS line up until about 1999. And so you can see most of that combined decline really was attributed to the SIDS deaths. But since that time where it started to level off, some of that might be explained, especially in the years from 1999 to 2001, where SIDS was decreasing and maybe you see accidental suffocation and unknown increasing. It was offset by an increase of those deaths. And what this next slide is showing is infant supine sleep position from 1992 to 2010, and this is from the National Infant Sleep Position Study. On the x-axis, you have the years. On the y-axis, you have the percent of infants who were put on their back to sleep. You can see that in 1992, there were about 13% of infants who were put on their back to sleep. During the 1990s, there was the back to sleep campaign and AAP encouraging back sleeping. And you see that from 1992 to 2000, that the number of infants put on their back to sleep increased up to 70%. But you can see after about 2001, you know, there's about 73% of infants who are sleeping on their back to sleep, and that percent really hasn't changed in the last decade. And when you want to look at the number of deaths, the proportion of deaths that were explained by autopsy or no autopsy at all, and we compare 1996 to 10 years later in 2006, we see that of these unexplained infant deaths, most of them were SIDS, about 84%. And very few were accidental suffocation, 2% in 1996. When you look at 2006, however, you see a lot fewer, a smaller proportion of deaths were actually called SIDS, but more were being called accidental suffocation and cause unknown. And now I'm going to tell you about what death certificates don't tell us about SUID. So we typically do our SUID surveillance or SID surveillance using vital records, our death certificates. And they are really limited, and let me tell you why. Here's an example of the section of the cause of death section from the U.S. death certificate. So this is the information that we can actually pull off the death certificate if we have access to that data. We're fortunate enough here to get the text fields from the death certificates for 2003 to 2004 to look at accidental suffocation and strangulation in bed, those deaths that were coded that way during those 2 years, to see if we might better understand the mechanisms for those deaths by what was written there. And what you can see here is on this graph is you see the different mechanisms on the x-axis, and then you have the percent of deaths on the y-axis. And what you see is about 35% of the time, if you look at that yellow bar, it's really, we don't know what the mechanism is from, it's unknown from the death certificate. There was nothing written in there. We have no idea. We do know that some deaths were reported as overlay, some as wedging, some as soft bedding, but there's so many unknown, and this is a limitation of using the death certificate to figure out mechanism attributed to suffocation deaths. At this next graph, we've done the same thing, except here we're looking at sleep surface or the place where the infant died. And again, more than 50% of these deaths, we had no idea whether the infant died on a bed, a sofa, or a crib. We do know that they did die in those places, but more than 55%, there was just no information on the death certificate. Again, when we wanted to look at whether bed sharing or co-sleeping was reported on the death certificate, more than 40% of the time, nothing was reported. And we do know that, yes, sometimes bed sharing was reported and sometimes not, but a big proportion of the time we have no idea. So death certificates really are limited. And what we need is more comprehensive data to increase our knowledge about the circumstances or factors that may have contributed to the death or caused the SUID case. So if we knew more about the sleep environment, we'd know more how to target interventions, you know, if sleep environment was a factor that led to the death. Knowing more about prior medical history will help us better determine new ways to classify these deaths and to get them from being unexplained into an explained category. And we also need to know, what was the quality of the death scene investigation? How comprehensive was it? Or was there even one done? And the same goes for the autopsy. What you can get off the death certificate is whether or not an autopsy was performed, but we know nothing about what tests were done for that autopsy or whether they followed any type of protocol. So what we need is a SUID surveillance system that builds upon child death review. And we really think that this is the answer, and it'll help us figure out, you know, of these unexplained deaths, you know, can we be certain that there was enough evidence to call these deaths suffocation, or are they truly unexplained and we need more data? So Lena's going to tell you now about the SUID surveillance system. Thank you.
Good afternoon. This is Lena Camperlengo. I'm a health scientist at CDC's SUID initiative in the Division of Reproductive Health. And this afternoon, I'm going to tell you a little bit about the SUID Case Registry pilot program. To start off, I want to build on what Carrie had just said here, and she sort of developed the need for a case registry. So let's start picking up from there and talk about what are the objectives of this case registry that we're talking about. Ultimately, we'd like to be able to create population-based surveillance at the state level that really builds on an existing system instead of reinventing an entire surveillance system. We'd like to be able to categorize these SUID cases using common characteristics. And once we've categorized those cases, then we can start to monitor the incidence of these categories. We'd also like to be able to describe what kind of demographic environmental factors are associated with each of these different categories of SUID cases. And then eventually, we'd like to be able to use this information to be able to inform prevention activities and ultimately save lives. We began the case registry with grantees that I'll discuss in a second. Ultimately, what we wanted to be able to do here is to be able to strengthen what's going on at the state level. So we wanted to build on an existing system and just be able to enhance what the state's ability is to identify, review, and enter cases for every single SUID case in their state. In doing so, we wanted to improve the completeness of the data that they were collecting and the quality of the data, as well as improving those investigations at a local jurisdictional level by promoting policy and practice changes. So when during our case registry, when we notice that something might be missing, at a local review, they can turn around and ask for an improvement within their own local investigation. The information in the case registry, we hope to inform national, state, and local policymakers and program planners, identify at-risk groups, and that way we can target specific prevention messages. And then eventually for researchers, we can use our case registry as a source of cases for case control studies. The model that we use for the case registry really does build on the existing child death review system that's already in place in 49 states. And in adding to what's already being done at the states, what we did is use variables, and we integrated some new suicide-specific variables into the National Center for Child Death Review, which is now renamed the National Center for the Review and Prevention of Child Death, their case reporting system. That V2.2S is what we shorthand the version 2.2 SUID case reporting system. So we've used existing variables and layered on new SUID-specific variables. Doing that, we really support states in their state mandates to review all infant deaths or all child deaths in that state. So we're really trying to support their efforts in which they already are trying to accomplish these goals. And overall, strengthen the state's ability to find these deaths, review them, and enter the data on these. Let's talk for a second about the variables that we include in the SUID case registry. I really view them as two separate types of variables. One that we call the individual variable really collects information on that infant. That includes the infant's sleep environment, maternal health during her pregnancy, any complications or injuries that might have happened to the mom while she was pregnant or the baby, infant health variables that include whether the child was sick or what the risk. Those are very much those individual-based variables. The systems-based variable collects information on the components of the death scene investigation as well as the components of an autopsy. So we're collecting information not only on the results, say, of toxicology, but we are asking, was toxicology performed? So we're assessing what was done and then what the results were from those tests. Schematic kind of gives all of you visual learners an overview of the different data sources. My colleague Carrie kind of described earlier the limitation on death certificates. I mean, death certificates are doing the job of what death certificates are supposed to be doing here, but what we need is more extensive information. So you'll see death certificates are just one piece of the puzzle that comes to the table. All of these different data sources come to the table to be reviewed during the SUID case registry process. That includes all the way to the left, the scene where the infant died, which includes the SUIDERF or the SUID investigation reporting form or local jurisdiction. Then moving on to first responders, hospital reports, any kind of medical records, social service, CPS, as well as from the medical examiner coroner's office, the autopsy, the death certificate, et cetera. And all of those data sources are then reviewed by a multidisciplinary team. For those of you unfamiliar with child death review teams, they typically involve a medical examiner coroner, someone from law enforcement, as a death investigator, a public health representative, EMS, some kind of healthcare provider, usually a pediatrician, and a representative from Child Protective Services. So then trying to summarize what the case registry is, it's a relationship-based process that must involve different disciplines sitting at the table so that each case is reviewed from all of these different perspectives. It's both qualitative and quantitative. And it can be used locally for assessing what's going on during a death investigation for an infant and how can we improve those death investigations. And then it can be used then for a driving data to action. What the case registry is not is a scavenger hunt. It's not a data linking project. It's not a fill-in-the-blank exercise. And it's not meant to be done in isolation. It really is relationship-based. And this multidisciplinary team is the heart of the program. The idea of how our information flows through the case registry we start at the beginning when an infant dies suddenly and unexpectedly. A team is notified. They start to gather information on that case. They review that case, enter the data, and then the state reviews the data for completeness and goes back for additional information if needed. And then eventually the data is pooled and CDC is sent the identified data set for analysis. All right, this slide here shows the SUI case registry grantee states. And I've got two colors here, the green states, Colorado, Georgia, Michigan, New Jersey, New Mexico, were all funded in August 2009, and they began data collection January 1st, 2010. The orange states, Minnesota and New Hampshire, began their funding in August 2010, and they began data collection January 1st of this year. The first year progress that we'd like to report on here is that the states, the grantees, really improved timeliness, and that means the time it took from the infant death to the time when the team was notified of the death, from that time to when it was reviewed, to when it was entered, et cetera. So they've really decreased the timeline here. They've improved the information from the death scene brought to the table during reviews, and the bullets underneath it describe some of the techniques that they use to do that, paying for completed information, death scene information, as well as training investigators on conducting DAL reenactment. They increased access to autopsy information, and they implemented quality improvement measures, which kind of lead us to year two and our successes from the second year of implementing the project. Some of the things we learned during the way, because this was a pilot project, is we really learned that it was very important that we had to have the data cleaned at the state level, especially when there were local teams and a state team involved. So we created a new variable for that. We actually launched a new case report, which I referred to earlier, our second version, version 2.2. And we included questions, very specific questions about what components were done during the death scene. And we added very specific questions about what was written in the death certificate. So we really improved completeness of data, and then we also moved and shifted from this data collection to also how are we impacting change at a local and state level? How are we influencing practice and policy change? In summary here, our 2010 SUID cases from five states, the five original states, they have identified over 867 cases, SUID cases in their five states. They've reviewed over 650, and they've completed quality assurance measures on 388 cases as of June 30th of this year. And now I'd like to acknowledge some of our colleagues at CDC, Rebecca Ludvigson, Nikita Boston, Terry Jirogi, and Shin Kim. At this point, I'd like to turn the presentation over to Terry Covington, the Executive Director for the National Center for the Review and Prevention of Child Death.
Hello, and thank you for being here today. I'm going to be talking about a little bit about what child death review can bring to our understanding about suffocation and SUID deaths, and what we've learned that states are currently doing to help reduce the risk. Many of you on the call know about child death review. Child death review is a process that helps improve the investigation and the provision of services to families, and it also is a process that helps to describe circumstances in infant sleep-related deaths when teams review those deaths. We do know that teams are across the country are reviewing deaths. There's a new Healthy People 2020 objective this year. It's still in the developmental stage, and it's under the Injury and Violence Prevention section of the Healthy People 2020 objectives, but it's to increase the number of states in the District of Columbia where at least 90% of sudden and unexpected deaths of infants are reviewed by child fatality teams. We had to compile baseline data for this objective, and we found that in 2007 across the U.S., there were 4,211 SUID deaths, and that combines the SIDS, the suffocations, and undetermined. And of that, 37 states reported to us that they were reviewing 68% of all those deaths. which at the time is a to us is a really good indicator that the states are really starting to increase their ability to review these deaths, in addition to the seven states that are reviewing all of them. As Lena mentioned in her discussion on the case registry, the teams are really actively reviewing the deaths and looking for circumstantial information on the cases. And one way that we're collecting this is through our national case reporting system. We have 40 states now using the reporting system, and many of them are, when they review a SUID death, it takes them to a special section and they can answer if the child was under the age of five and if the death was related to sleeping or the sleep environment. And there's a whole series of questions that people can answer related to these deaths, i.e. whether the where the baby was sleeping, what kind of bed it was, where they were put to sleep, where they were found, what was their usual sleep place, usual sleep position, and then questions related to whether the child's airway was obstructed or fully, partially, or not obstructed, and if it was obstructed, what position was most relevant to that obstruction. We were able to compile some summary data on this so far. But I just want to show you a couple examples of what child death review can tell us. So in the old days, when I first started working in child death review in the early 1990s, we would have reviews in which information would be brought to the team. And for example, we were told that the baby was sleeping in a bassinet and died of SIDS. What we believe has happened in the last 10 to 15 years with improved death investigations is that we now know that, yes, the baby may have been sleeping in a bassinet, but it was covered with a blanket. Or, yes, the baby may have been sleeping with an adult, but the baby was found sleeping under the adult's arms. And this is all information that's starting to be gathered through improved scene investigations. We may know that the baby was sleeping in an adult bed, and I don't know who sleeps in a bed that looks this pristine, but good investigation will bring to the case review that this is what the bed actually looked like. Lots of pillows, lots of fluffy materials, soft bedding, etc. We also hear the baby may have died in a pack and play. And in our head, this is, in the old days, this is how we were picturing the baby, but a good scene investigation may tell us that the pack and play was full of a lot of soft baby paraphernalia. We may now get good scene photos on the deaths that are reviewed. Scene photos can provide so much more information on the circumstances in an infant death. We also know that babies are not only dying in bedding, but they're dying in other child and infant paraphernalia, such as car seats and strollers. And good doll reenactments can illustrate how those deaths occurred. The other thing teams are bringing to the reviews is information on the mother's maternal health history, how the baby was fed, and whether the baby was breastfed or bottle-fed, whether the babies were swaddled, what the room temperature was at the time of the death, and all sorts of other information. Some of the preliminary data that we have from our case reporting system, and this is very preliminary and it's not yet published, but we ran some data just to sort of see what the scope of our information was. So in November, we had data from 28 states, and we had 30,920 infant deaths. We pulled from the case reporting system the deaths in which the team reported that the infant's airway was fully or partially obstructed. And you can see that we had, of those deaths, 1,613 suffocations, 201 SIDS, and 459 deaths of undetermined or unknown cause. In 45% of the suffocation deaths, the team reported that soft bedding was relevant to the death, or that sharing a sleep surface was relevant to the death. For the SIDS, soft bedding 76% for the soft bedding and 16% for sharing a sleep surface. And in the undetermined, it was 62% and 37% respectively. We also discovered that the infant's sleep place in all of the deaths in which the child's airway was obstructed, the adult bed was the place of sleep for approximately 50% of all of those. So we're getting good information on risk factors from our team's reviews, and the seven states that are participating in the case registry are actually even providing more information related to risk factors. In 2012, we're going to be moving into version 3.0 for the case reporting system, and all of the states that are currently using it will all move into those expanded questions. So we're hoping in another year or two we'll have much more complete and comprehensive information from all of the teams that are participating, which would be at this point be at least 40 states. So we always wonder, what are the states doing with all this information on risk factors? And at our center, we receive numerous calls on a regular basis for information on what other states are doing. And we ourselves were sort of curious about this. What are states doing? We sent out a poll earlier this year, asking state MCH and injury programs to sort of give us a sense of what they were doing related to safe sleep. We received responses from 37 states. We knew that a lot of the states were busy doing, had created brochures and pamphlets related to safe sleep, but we were also pleasantly surprised at the number of states that were doing hospital discharge instruction, crib distribution, and a lot of states had actual dedicated websites that focused on safe sleep. At least, I think it was 21 states had those. So people were, you know, really doing a lot of work around safe sleep. Now, one thing we did learn through our responses is that there wasn't coordinated activity state to state. Everyone out there is sort of doing their own thing. And a lot of them have developed their own materials, their own campaigns, although some are using standardized materials available through the federal government at the NIHCD. We also asked them which part of the American Academy of Pediatric message related to safe sleep they are explicitly including in their state safe sleep messaging. The largest response, not surprisingly, were back to sleep messages. But we also were really pretty surprised to hear that the majority were including in their messaging the use of firm sleep surfacing, not using soft objects or loose bedding, not using heavy blankets, and sleeping in a separate but proximate location. We were really kind of pleasantly surprised, and we were also surprised that the majority of the states were explicitly stating that bed sharing is not a safe practice for safe infant sleep. These are just some examples of the materials that are out there across the country. As you can see, very different styling, different targeted messages, and I could come up with 37 examples, and every one of them would be different in terms of what the states have created. But there's a lot of real creative work going on in the states. A number of states, this picture on the left is actually my agency, the Michigan Public Health Institute. We have a wellness program that sends a safe sleep kit to all new babies that are employees of the Institute, including a safe sleep sack that we've embroidered with the company logo. There are a number of places that we heard from across the country that are doing safe sleep displays in their health departments. This one on the right is a health department in which this is in the health department lobby, and people coming into the WIC clinic can look at this, and then when they go to their WIC appointment, if they can answer a safe sleep quiz correctly, they actually receive a pack and play. So there's a huge incentive to sort of study this little exhibit and then to be able to go in and get their, and I believe that's through a Cribs for Kids distribution program. There's also a lot of states that are targeting special populations, Hispanic families, African-American families. Minnesota has materials specifically targeted to their Hmong populations. That doesn't mean that we're all doing a good job reaching populations minority populations in particular, because we know that the death rates there are disproportionately high. We also found that it's not always the health department in states that are taking the lead. Social services, surprisingly, had the lead in 6 of the 37 states. The medical examiner's office in 2. Nonprofit SIDS organizations are still taking the lead. And other organizations such as hospital groups or American Academy of Pediatric chapters, et cetera. So it's not always just the health department that have decided to take the lead in their state. But we also heard that in many states there's pretty broad coordination. A number of states have what they call safe sleep coalitions, or a derivative of that, that are working across agencies to develop these campaigns. And we're also finding that states along that same line are trying to bring in a lot of partners. This is an example of some work that's happened in Delaware, where they have a multi-agency mass media effort. These are bus board signs that they have placed on bus boards throughout Delaware. This is an example from the SID Center of New Jersey that has worked to institutionalize their safe sleep messaging. And you can see the agencies that they've involved in that, Child Protection Services, primary care centers, nursing staff at the neonatal centers, maternal and child health, child care programs, and education programs across the state for their Safe Sleep for Your Baby campaign. Just, there's a lot, what I'm really trying to say is there's a lot of really, really good examples across the country of work that people are currently doing. This is an example of a pretty comprehensive effort in Minnesota where they have a website and they have a pretty comprehensive safe and asleep campaign where you can receive information. There's information for the coroners and medical examiners. There's information for professionals, information obviously for families. But they've really got a pretty full campaign that's, again, a multi-agency effort. The one thing we did learn, however, and we know that states struggle, is that as much work as they put out there trying to promote safe sleep, their families are also receiving many, many inconsistent messaging. We all know that you can open up any parent magazine and you'll see babies in unsafe sleep situations. Dr. Rachel Moon actually published a paper showing the vast majority of parenting and family magazines still show babies sleeping in unsafe sleep environments. And then there's the whole family bed and proponents of bed sharing that families are constantly working against. And even this example on the right was a safe sleep campaign brochure, but you can see where the baby's sleeping with her face down into the pillow. So, you know, it's those kinds of things that just deliver inconsistent messages, and it's constantly a struggle for states to try to balance the messaging that they're trying to send out with the messaging that parents are often getting from other sources. And for us, the bottom line for that is that if babies could talk, what they'd really try to tell us is that we need to get our act together. That, you know, as much as the states are working really, really hard to try to figure all of this out, what I believe has to happen nationally is more of a coordinated effort and coordinated messaging to help the states really come up with consistent messaging and figure out in a way so that everyone doesn't have to try to create their own efforts how to get this messaging out to families so that babies quit dying in these unsafe sleep environments. I'm going to turn now to Lindsay Meyer, who is the Director of Injury Prevention for the Colorado Health Department. And Lindsay's going to describe, in a sense, some of the work that I just described, but she's going to talk about it from one state, which is the state of Colorado.
Hi, everyone. Thanks for the introduction, Terry. As she mentioned, I'm the Injury and Violence Prevention Program Manager for the Colorado State Health Department, and I have been the principal investigator on our sudden unexpected infant death case registry project. So I will give you a little overview, like Terry said, of how our state is applying the information that we have learned through the SUDI case registry, as well as how we're collaborating with other partners in our state to move forward on some of the recommendations that are coming out of looking at our child fatality review data and some of the things that are in the system that we've been noticing for a lot of years, but haven't until recently had sort of the momentum to really focus in a unified way on how to apply that at a state and even a local level. The case registry has been a really great opportunity for us to kind of look at our child fatality system overall, and so we're really excited to have participated in it and feel like it's been really beneficial to our state. So just a little bit about our child fatality prevention system. We've had a system in Colorado for a long time. 1989, though we just relatively recently became legislatively mandated in 2005. So you can see here we have, this is some details just about our state legislation. We have a rather large state team and break that team up into different subcommittees to do case reviews on various topics. We review all child deaths in the state of Colorado that occur for children under age 18. So we have looked at our sudden unexpected infant death for years, but the case registry has really given us the opportunity to look at things a little bit more currently. We're actually now, since publishing these slides, we've actually started reviewing 2009 cases from our regular child fatality review, but for our case registry, we are looking at 2011 deaths currently. So this is a little bit about our process. I won't go into this since Lena gave a good overview of this in her presentation. But once we are notified by our Office of Vital Statistics is how we receive notifications of infant deaths. And once we receive information that the death has occurred, we collect a number of reports that'll help identify the circumstances related to the death and give us the information that we need to fill out the case registry form that Lena and Terry both mentioned. We do case abstraction, so we actually look at the cases, look at all the reports that we gather and abstract the cases in advance of our reviews so that we can really focus our discussion and our time at the reviews in answering any questions or discrepancies between reports and really focusing on the prevention factors or the factors that may inform prevention strategies for our state. So to date, we've actually, in 2010, we just finalized our final numbers for 2010, and we actually had 58 cases that we reviewed that occurred in 2010, and have identified 10 cases in 2011 so far, so it's certainly an ongoing process. The common risk factors that we're seeing are many of the things, or all of the things actually, that Terry mentioned. A lot of bed sharing, soft bedding, unsafe sleep position. So there's, a lot of risk factors to go on to develop the prevention recommendations. In Colorado, we give recommendations from our team on three different levels. We look at systems recommendations about the death scene, autopsies, as well as give recommendations to other state agencies like the Department of Human Services to, help inform sort of our systems that can be improved and help protect our kids. We also make policy and legislative recommendations. And then a bulk of our recommendations, particularly on this issue, are community-level education for education or programs that will help families directly and really get the safe sleep message out there. So I'm going to give you just in the next couple of slides a few examples of the recommendations that come from our multidisciplinary review meetings. We look at, for investigation recommendations, we have a coroner system in Colorado and don't have kind of a centralized oversight over how those coroner offices run, and so there's a lot of inconsistency both in law enforcement and in our coroner's office about the use of the tools like the SUDERF, which is a reporting tool that agencies can fill out to help them identify all the information they need at the scene to investigate the death. And so we have very few agencies actually using that form on a consistent basis, which means there's a lot of discrepancies in how the agencies are investigating these deaths and the information that we're able to then put into our case registry system. So we've recommended pretty consistently that we need more dollar reenactment in this state. We need to really think about training for law enforcement and other investigating agencies to help improve these investigations. On the autopsy side, again, sort of education for coroners around filling out death certificates correctly. We have lots of inconsistency, as is true in the nation, around how deaths are coded, which makes it really difficult to tease out what the data means when you get it. So these are some examples of those recommendations. on the prevention side, we have really tried to focus on, you know, the fact that we don't have kind of a statewide effort going on, well, we didn't until recently, around safe sleep. And so a lot of our recommendations have kind of stemmed from that. We've, on individual cases, really felt the need to figure out some sort of way to get better professional education to hospital nurses and home visitation nurses, social workers, et cetera. And so we took all of this information that has come from the individual case reviews, and we really try to aggregate it and take a look at it as a group. And then, you know, rather than just focus on one case specifically, we try to look at the data as a whole and see where the commonalities are and where we could have the biggest impact. In Colorado, we have a state-level review process for our SUDI case registry, but we do have six currently local teams that are also doing the same process at the local level. Many states have local teams in all counties and kind of conduct their child fatality or child death reviews in that way. In Colorado, we are unfortunately a state-level review for the most part, though we do have some agencies that are really working very hard to do this work at the local level. And just like Terry mentioned in her presentation that states are doing different things, we've learned that our few local child fatality review agencies, as well as local hospitals, et cetera, are also doing very different things in terms of safe sleep messaging. And so the idea is to really try to figure out where we can be more consistent. So I'm going to give you just an example of two counties that have been really active in the safe sleep realm. This one comes from El Paso and Teller County, their review program there. And they've done, this is an example of some of the activities that they've done and the messaging that they've worked on. One thing in talking to the coordinator of the child fatality review there that struck me is, you know, just they did some focus groups to see what messaging they should use. And they were finding that in their community, the term safe sleep wasn't resonating very well with the people that they surveyed, that they were sometimes likening the term safe sleep to safe sex, and that was not exactly, you know, the message that they were meaning to get across in their materials. So they added, you know, the term reduce the risk of SIDS so that it would make that connection for people in a really easy way. Since we developed these slides a little while ago, the El Paso County actually has started a Cribs for Kids program as well, and has been successful in distributing 85 cribs since just last April. So they're really moving forward really well in a very short period of time. The cribs have been distributed, many of them, to homeless moms, and including four sets of twins and things like that. So this community is really doing a lot of great things. Another good example from Colorado is Mesa County. And they've done a number of things, including putting together a 30-minute segment on their government access channel featuring the coroner and law enforcement and pediatricians in their area, and really tried to tackle this problem from a variety of different angles, which I thought was really great for their campaign. Unlike El Paso County, which really felt the need to tie the word SIDS into their message, Mesa County doesn't use the term SIDS at all. They have a coroner who doesn't use that terminology. He rules deaths undetermined if he can't find a definitive cause of death, and doesn't use that terminology. And so they felt it was really important not to use that terminology in their prevention campaigns as well. So you can kind of see, even just in two examples, how the messaging can really differ from place to place, though the meat of it is the same. Most communities are using the AAP guidelines and those things in their messages, and sometimes targeting different pieces of it, but there's an overall inconsistency in the messaging. So we really wanted to start a statewide safe sleep initiative to tackle some of these problems. And in doing so, we really wanted to collaborate with many different partners to really link our maternal child health programs, our injury prevention programs, child fatality prevention system, our Safe Kids office. Our Department of Human Services has been very interested in this issue. So we have kind of all pulled together to start talking about these issues and think what we can do together to improve our chances of getting that consistent messaging. So we collaborated with our Children's Hospital and Safe Kids Colorado, which is housed there currently, to host a Safe Sleep Summit last January. And we reviewed the data that we had to date from our case registry and talked about kind of what was going on around the state. We invited many different partners to the table and really found that, you know, people are interested in this issue from a variety of different perspectives, from a variety of different agencies, and the more we can bring people to the table, the better this initiative is going to be. So we were successful in getting lots of partners to the table for our meeting. During the meeting, we identified many of the challenges that Terry discussed. Inconsistent messaging, particularly messaging between sort of the breastfeeding community or lactation specialists and the injury prevention folks or child fatality review folks around recommendations about where the baby should be placed to sleep. And then some of the just, you know, regular challenges with any issue, limited funding and program evaluation is particularly difficult in this arena because of the data and the shifts in diagnoses and things for this sleep-related deaths. So we created some roundtables and talked, four roundtables, one on messaging, one on community strategies, provider strategies, and policy, and talked about a number of different ideas just to get us started. And so we really came out of this meeting with a lot of really valuable information that we now are continuing to use as we move forward. Our outcomes of our summit is that the folks that attended really agreed that there was a need for a statewide initiative, that we wanted to promote the AAP guidelines and are eagerly awaiting for the new ones to come out. We got commitments of participation from many agencies that were there, including people who identified themselves as wanting to be a leader in the effort. And we drafted a vision statement, kind of a rough draft of that at during the meeting. Our next steps, we have developed a Safe Sleep Coalition since this meeting occurred and have initially set up three different subcommittees to focus on different topics, data evaluation, messaging, and funding. And are really moving forward on some of the things that came out of those roundtable discussions. We were conducting a literature review on best practices and pulling from existing resources that already have kind of collected that information, so trying to be good about using our national resources. We are waiting for IRB approval, or rather the Children's Hospital is waiting for IRB approval for a survey that'll go out to providers and parents through various hospital systems in our state to try to establish what practices they are planning to do and to get a little information that'll help us target our messaging better. We are eagerly awaiting, like I said, the new guidelines from the AAP so that we can really do a big media push at that time and start to really promote those recommendations. We're also in the process of taking all this and putting it into a more formalized strategic plan so that we can organize our work and figure out how the partnership between all of these agencies is going to move forward. We've identified a couple of different opportunities to apply for some funding, both from sort of existing foundations in our community, and local donors, as well as some national grant opportunities that we're trying to pursue. And so we're really excited about this. We feel like this public-private partnership could be really beneficial both for the funding of potential projects that the coalition is going to be working on, but also because it'll really help us disseminate the message. And we are also really working with our maternal and child health program here at the state level to figure out a way for local maternal and child health programs to be able to work on this issue and use some of their MCH dollars to enhance the safe sleep work that may already be going on in their community. And our ultimate goal is to really get partners around the state using the same language, make it easier for parents to understand safe sleep recommendations and start to see some of these numbers decrease in our state. So that is all I have. I'm going to turn it over to Michael Goodstein, who is an attending a neonatologist at York Hospital.
Thank you very much, Lindsay. It's a pleasure to be with you here today to discuss our hospital-based community-wide infant sleep safety program. In the next 20 minutes, I'll be sharing with you a brief overview of the events that led to the development of this program, followed by the program components, and most importantly, how we put this program together and how you can do it too in your local community. And I'll finish with some of the research outcomes that we are preparing for publication. To provide some background into our population, this program is centered in York County, Pennsylvania. We have an interesting mix of rural, city, and suburban components, totaling 450,000 people. About 85% of our population is Caucasian, and the rest is divided equally between African American and Latinos. Our community has about 4,500 deliveries per year. In 2004, we became a member of the Cribs for Kids organization, which Judy Bannon will be talking about next. And we've had great success in educating families and providing a safe sleep environment for babies at risk. However, we were having some difficulties with our SUID rates that were not decreasing. And just to kind of show you what was going on, these are our coroner cases on this slide. And all the infant coroner cases are in the blue here. Our SUID cases, which are about six per year, are in these red bars. And what was really disturbing to us is the white bars, which reveal the SUID cases where the babies are found in an unsafe sleep environment. And it really revealed to us that the vast majority of these deaths may have been preventable. But we also came to the realization that every single family needed to hear the same message. We realized that infant sleep safety requires a consistent and repetitive message in the community to prevent accidental deaths. And part of the problem is that people are just all too happy to share their thoughts on taking care of a baby when you're a new parent. And this will include family and friends, different healthcare providers. There's so much information out there on the internet and magazines. And unfortunately, there are conflicting messages as a norm. And that makes it very difficult for a family to know what the best practice should be. And in the worst case scenario, what happens is when you're not sure what to do, you turn to your mother. And so the grandmother will say, gee, when you were a baby, we always put babies on their tummies, and it was good enough for you, it's good enough for my grandson. And in this brief conversation, we have now just doubled the chance of this baby dying of SIDS. So we developed a hospital-based program, but this is really just kind of a centerpiece as part of a continuum from really pre-pregnancy into prenatal care that goes through the time of delivery when they're in the hospital, where we can really do some good modeling for them. And it continues through infancy with anticipatory guidance in the physician's office, whether it's the pediatrician or family doctor. But we chose to make the centerpiece a hospital-based program because it's the only way to capture 100% of the birthing population for this education. And it's a point of intersection for all the members of the healthcare team, including the obstetrical team, pediatricians, lactation counselors, with family members, and not just the parents, but the grandparents and other relatives and friends who may be intimately involved with the care of this baby during the first year of life. In our program, nurses are critical role models that they do provide modeling, because it's not just what you say, it's what the parents see you do. And this program is efficient and cost-effective. The goal of this program was to reduce the risk of injury or death to infants while sleeping. We want to be able to provide accurate and consistent infant safe sleep information to hospital personnel. We want hospitals to be able to implement and model infant safe sleep practices throughout the facility, so not just in the newborn nursery, but on your pediatric floor and in your emergency department and your NICU if you have one. And we also want to be able to provide direction to healthcare professionals in and out of the hospital so that parents receive that consistent, repetitive safe sleep education. The model that we chose to use for our program was a replication of the Shake and Baby program, now called the Abusive Head Trauma Program. Mark Diaz, who's a pediatric neurosurgeon now at Hershey Medical Center, studied this when he developed it up in Buffalo, New York, and they reported a 50% reduction in their shaken baby injuries with a good education program for families. So we modeled those program components. We have a DVD presentation on infant sleep safety, which then is followed by a face-to-face review with the nursing staff and appropriate modeling of a safe sleep environment, and then we have the family sign a voluntary acknowledgement statement that they understand the information that's been given to them. These are the DVDs that we use. There are many different products out there. The Safe Sleep for Your Baby Right from the Start is available from Cribs for Kids. First Candle has a very nice DVD as well. The reason that our program chose the Safe Sleep DVD is that, one, it's a multicultural DVD, and secondly, we like the way it was presented in a series of vignettes, and after each vignette, there would be reinforcement of the main message that would come across in writing on the screen, and then it would be reinforced again by a pediatrician explaining why that particular message was important. Unfortunately, this has not been developed yet in Spanish, so we turned to SIDS of Illinois, who had developed a similar disc called Dormir Seguro para un Bebé, which is done in a similar fashion using a series of vignettes with written points coming across the screen periodically. Before a baby is discharged from our hospital, all parents have to view the Safe Sleep DVD, and then the nurses do the one-on-one education and model the Safe Sleep environment, and they also review the Safe Sleep for Your Baby pamphlet. We also, just as important, as we confirm that there is a safe place for this baby to sleep, and if not, we do a social work referral to obtain a pack and play through our local Cribs for Kids program. The voluntary acknowledgement statement says that I received this information and understand that baby should sleep on the back and that sleeping with my baby increases the risk of my baby dying from SIDS. Maybe a little bit of a brutal statement, but it's an honest statement, and we want people to hear the truth. This is an acknowledgement form only, though. When they sign this, it's not a legal document that anybody's going to come in and check up on them. But we did want to focus families on the importance of this information for their baby's health. And again, this was not for legal purposes, but it does protect the hospital on a certain level, because this way nobody can ever come back, if a tragedy does happen, and say that they were not given this information and things were not explained to them. Those are the basic components of our program, but we have developed some supplemental components beyond that that are also easy to implement. We put posters prominently in every labor hall room, every maternity room, every pediatric room in the hospital, and we offered it to all of our obstetrical, pediatric, and family practice offices. We made sleep sacks available for purchase at discount at our gift shop and lactation center, and some of the surrounding hospitals in our area are actually now giving one away free to each family as a present for their delivery at the hospital. We also developed a display nursery, which we call our Infant Sleep Safety Center, which is present right at the entrance to maternity. So every person from the community who comes in to visit a new mother will see that display and be reminded about infant sleep safety. And then for people who call into the hospital, there are rotating series of messages while you're on hold, and we made sure that a message on safe sleep was part of that rotating message. It comes up every few months, and we make sure that it's available during SIDS Awareness Month. These are the posters that we use. We obtained these from the CJ Foundation, and then we modified them for our local use with our local information. This is the Infant Sleep Safety Center that I was referring to. We did a little cat in the fiddle kind of motif, and we have kind of a mobile scenario hanging down. So people are drawn to it. It's rather attractive. We do have in here a DVD player that runs Safe Sleep information throughout the day. We have a brochure rack set up. And again, this is all set up near the entrance to our maternity area, so people are constantly reminded of this. Now, once we got this program put in place, people started asking us, well, how did you do that and how can we do that? And I have to admit that I wasn't so smart that I had a grand scheme put in place for doing this. Different pieces came up from different ideas that people had, and we kind of incorporated it. But in order to explain it easier to folks, I did go back and create this organizational chart on how to put together a hospital-based infant safe sleep program, and it has three main components, one of the most important of which is to achieve program acceptance, and there are a series of different groups of people at your institution that you'll want to get involved with this. We had to develop our curriculum, including initial staff education and then a way to maintain that education, as well as developing a program of family education. And then the third part is who's going to be doing the work on this program, who are going to be the volunteers, and we did this mostly through our Cribs for Kids program, but we did look for community support, and there are lots of people that all share the same goals of promoting health in our community and preventing these tragic deaths, and that would include your local health department or bureau, a Safe Kids Coalition, as I mentioned, our Cribs for Kids program, child death review teams, and one that I left off here were first responders and EMS people who don't want to be getting called into these situations that were potentially preventable. So in terms of getting your hospital on board on this, the first thing that you really want to do is have some sort of presentation for your administration. And a key person or player that will be able to provide a support and perhaps have a passion for this kind of program will be from a physician who's already knowledgeable about SIDS and SUID, whether this is a neonatologist or an emergency room doctor who's been involved with one of these cases or a pediatrician. It's good to have somebody like that on board to support your cause. When we presented this information to our administration, we made sure they understood the scope of the problem, and not just on a national level, but also the local statistics and why it's important for our community to embrace this. We focus on the logistics of the program, that it's a successful program model that has already produced excellent public health results, and then what every administrator likes to hear, that it's an inexpensive program, that it's cost-effective. So we focus on the statistics, and again, some of these numbers have been brought up through the course of our discussions this afternoon, but that SIDS is the third leading cause of death throughout all infancy. It's the number one leading cause of death for postneonatal period, and that we have 4,500 babies dying suddenly, unexpectedly every year in this country. That comes out to one death every 2 hours of every day of the year as another death of a baby unexpectedly in this country, and those numbers are just appalling. And once we get on board with administration, then you need to focus on getting your staff to accept or buy in to this program. And again, the people to focus on were our pediatric and newborn nursery nurses who had some knowledge about SUID, and they would make quick allies. And at our hospital, we don't have a pediatric emergency department, so a lot of times nurses from the NICU as well as the doctors get called down to help out in these cases. And so when you see the tragedy firsthand, it really does empower you to just want to do everything you can to prevent these cases from happening. Now, you do get a little bit of pushback sometimes or resistance to not another program. We know that in the newborn nursery, the nurses are very busy. There's a lot of information that has to be transmitted to parents in a short period of time. But I really do challenge staff to focus on what's most important, because our goal as healthcare providers is there are a couple of goals. We want to make ill people well again, but we also want to do preventative care as well. So we kind of focus on the concept this is a program to reduce local infant mortality. I challenge nurses. I say, I've never seen a baby come back to my emergency department who has died because their bath wasn't perfect and they had some dirt behind their ears, but I've seen lots of babies come back dead because parents didn't know how to sleep their babies safely. And again, in building up this coalition of people, we make use of statistics and, again, the evidence-based medicine. And this is data from Judy's area in Allegheny County in Pennsylvania, a study of almost 90 SIDS deaths over a four-year period. And clearly, the vast majority, almost 90% of them, were found in an unsafe sleep environment. So it's so important that we get that message out about the environment. In order to get nurse buy-in, we started at the top with our nurse managers in the newborn nursery, our intensive care nursery, labor and delivery, pediatrics, and our emergency department. We then had discussions at staff organizational levels, focusing on multidisciplinary committees like our neonatal care and newborn care committees, and then we went into the nursing councils, their education and practice councils, and we went there because the nurse leaders are there who can support the dissemination of this program concept to the general staff. And once we started spreading the word about this, there were follow-up discussions at nurse staff meetings, and it was reinforced through emails. One of the first things we did in developing our program was to make sure that we had an infant sleep safety policy for the hospital. One of the most important things is that it sets the standard of care at the institution, because lots of people do different things in how they care for the babies in the nursery, and when you ask them why they do it that way, it's because a lot of times it's because this is the way we've always done it, and that's not really a good answer. We want to use evidence-based medicine and have a standard of care so that people aren't doing things differently. We have to have consistency in modeling what we're doing for families. There are sample policies available online at the Allegheny County Department of Health, as well as First Candle's website. Our policy at York Hospital was modified from the Allegheny sample and then was merged with existing policy. It was finalized then through our newborn and pediatric hospital committees. In terms of how we go about doing the hospital nursing and other staffs as respiratory therapists and translators, their education, you really can have a choice between in-service lectures and computer-based training. In order to get people to lectures, you really need to make things mandatory if you're going to achieve the full compliance that you want. Sometimes there can be some difficulties in that people look at this as non-productive hours, but it is really critical information and standard of care at the hospital. In that regard, computer-based training may be easier to do because people can even do that from home, but I'm concerned that the teaching may not be as effective because when people have emotions built into this, they have feelings about how they raise their own children, we really want to have the opportunity to talk face-to-face and answer questions and get people to understand the data and why it's important to do things the way we're asking them to do it. One way to get people more involved with this is to provide CME credits, but what's even more helpful is to provide food at the meetings. Now, how do we go about developing our lectures? Well, we had a core group of volunteers who wanted to provide the lectures, and they developed a PowerPoint presentation and had practice sessions, and the materials that we used included the AAP SIDS Task Force policy statement, NIH materials, and Critics for Kids lecture materials. And then we developed supplemental poster boards that we put in clinical areas as reminders for the staff. And then when they got their education, we made it mandatory that they view the Safe Sleep DVD because this reinforced the material and also made the staff very much aware of what the parents would be seeing when they watched the DVD. We learned from our early sessions with educating staff that there were some pitfalls that we needed to kind of work our way around. We had to focus on back versus side sleeping and the fear of aspiration, because even though we've been doing back to sleep for almost 20 years now, there are still some people in the newborn nursery who have concerns about babies laying on their back and their ability to protect their airway, which they are perfectly able to do. So this was a real point of focus that we had for our education. Also, there was some pushback that came back about the program, saying you're anti-bonding, you're anti-breastfeeding, and these things were just untrue, and we had to make it very clear that, you know, a baby needs a safe place to sleep. That doesn't mean that a mother can't have the baby in bed with her to cuddle and play with the baby, or that she shouldn't be able to do breastfeeding in the adult bed, but they need to be very aware that when the parent is getting drowsy, then it's time for that baby to be put back in a proximate but separate safe sleep environment. And again, we tried to eliminate emotion by focusing on the evidence-based medicine. Once we had put together our program for education in place, we wanted to make sure that there was a way for staff to maintain their education. And we made use of the Safe Sleep Toolkit that we put at the nurse's station, and this was modified from one that was put together in Allegheny County. And in this toolkit, it included the hospital safe sleep policy, as well as a review of appropriate practices and explanation for the physiology of why we do what we do. And it also had little dialogues and discussion points to review things with families if they had questions. We also developed an information flip charts, which were really nice because on the back of each page from what the parent was seeing, there were scripted prompts and statistics so that the information stayed uniform from nurse to nurse and session to session. And then for the long term, we developed a computer-based review course with a test that would be part of the nurse's yearly competencies to make sure that they maintained their level of education to provide education to the public. We went further, though, beyond the hospital. We went into our community, into the local physician offices to lecture during their staff meetings, and we focused on the pediatric and obstetrical offices. And in the OB offices, we focused on the prenatal educators, since they are the ones who are going to be getting people started with this education process before they deliver. We provided our posters and teaching materials to all these offices, and we also discussed the fact that there's a lot of bad information in free magazines about pregnancy and delivery, as was mentioned from Dr. Moon's research. And you look in these magazines, and there are all these advertisements showing unsafe sleep environments, just trying to sell stuff to people. Because we have so many small family practice groups, we just did a grand rounds for them. We also did education for our emergency department, as well as our visiting nurse association, because they're out there in the trenches seeing what's going on and what the bed and crib environment looks like in the home. So we wanted them to be very aware of being able to provide education right there on site. We focus on Red Cross educators because they do babysitting classes, and again, of course, we focus on prenatal class educators. In terms of the anticipated outcomes with this kind of community-wide program, we know the Back to Sleep campaign was very successful with a 50% reduction in SIDS deaths, with a compliance at best in the 80s, but more typically in the 70% range. The Shaken Baby program we mentioned had a 50% reduction in abusive head trauma injuries. Some SUID experts estimate that up to 90% of these deaths are related to suffocation. So we think it's a very reasonable expectation that with a consistent message in the community that up to 50% of these SIDS and SUID events could be potentially eliminated. How much does a program like this cost? Not very much. The DVD that we use costs $20. The acknowledgement statement is simple paper supplies as well as the Safe Sleep Toolkit. Educational brochures can be obtained for free from the NIH. The computer-based training we'll give to people who want to use it at no charge. And then it's just volunteers to assist with the education within a particular hospital or community. I'm going to finish up with some of our program results because we do like to look at the evidence basis for what we do. So before we put our program in place, it was a six-month period where we collected baseline data, and then we collected additional data 6 months through the initiation of the program. During this time, we had over 2,700 healthy deliveries, and we got over 2,200 surveys back. We discovered that people actually had a very excellent knowledge baseline about the sleep environment, that about 95% of people knew that a baby should be laying on the back. Almost everybody knew. Yes?
Sorry to interrupt. We have 1 minute.
Okay, I'm finishing up. Okay.
Great, thanks.
Okay, sure. And that most people knew that a baby should be in a crib, but that knowledge doesn't equal intent, and that we found that there was a 15% decrease from knowing what to do and doing what you're supposed to do. And we saw a lot of improvement with the program results, that drop-off in knowing what position that people were actually going to use, it went up from 82 to 97%. Using the bassinet all the time increased from 81 to 92%. And we also saw in our healthcare providers that their understanding of the AAP guidelines, their approval of them, and feeling comfortable about infant sleep safety all improved with statistical significance. In conclusion, a hospital-based community-wide infant sleep safety program can be maintained successfully at minimal cost. But to be successful, you must identify infant sleep safe champions, you must build consensus in your community, and it will take some effort, time, and passion. I'm going to skip through this. We have a bunch of programs that have already replicated this or in the process of doing it. You know, we are trying to achieve a cultural shift here that I won't go into here. And I did supply people with some references and my contact information if they're interested in this. So at this point, I'll thank you, and I'm going to turn things over to Judy Bannon, who is the executive director of SIDS of Pennsylvania, and she is the creator of the Cribs for Kids program.
Thank you, Michael, and I'll get my slides up here. Okay, Cribs for Kids, if anyone out there isn't aware of who we are, is a national safe sleep education program that with the intervention of a crib for families in need. Cribs for Kids originated in Allegheny County, Pennsylvania in 1998 through the combined efforts of a lot of community leaders such as our district attorney, the mayor, Commander Gwen Elliott of our Pittsburgh Police Department, who was on the Child Death Review Team, and we put together a steering committee consisting of public health people, political and business leaders, and again, members of our Child Death Review Teams. Child Death Review was instrumental in bringing us all the information that we needed to decide a very important thing, and that was that the baby's dying of what at the time were being called SIDS were actually found in unsafe sleeping environments, and we knew that if we could change the sleeping environment, we would be successful in reducing our rates of sudden infant death syndrome and sudden unexplained and undetermined deaths. Michael mentioned our study between 2001 and 2006. The Allegheny County Health Department did a study that determined that of the 68 deaths that occurred and were diagnosed as SIDS or SUID, only two of them carried no risk factors. So that really went hand in hand with what we saw in 1998 when we started looking at the death scene investigations that our coroner was so kind as to give us to look at. What we found was the overwhelming majority of these babies who died of SUID or SIDS were discovered in unacceptable sleep positions or sleep locations. and the overwhelming majority of these babies that continued to die were African American. We were so successful in what we did, we actually reduced our rate, our numbers from, in 1998, we had 17 of these deaths in Allegheny County, and by 2004, that number had dropped to 5. So with that success, other groups from around the country started to call and say, we want to replicate your program. They were made aware of our program through Terry Covington as she roamed the country. I always knew where Terry was giving a talk at the time because I would start getting calls from members of Child Death Review teams saying, could you share your Cribs for Kids program with us? I was happy to do that, and at this time, we have 262 partners throughout the country. Actually, my slides are a little old. We just did a recount, and we have 310 partners. But the breakdown of those partners are about the same. 59 of them were health departments or social service agencies. 32 were hospitals. 47 were Safe Kids Coalitions, and our number of Safe Kids Coalitions have gone up to about 61. 119 were community-based organizations, SIDS organizations, Healthy Start, Healthy Mothers, Healthy Babies, and organizations like that. And 5 were groups who maybe were a junior women's league who decided to raise money and put babies into cribs, but it was really a one-time project. Dr. Shapira Mendoza was very clear when she gave her definition of SUID and SIDS. And what we always say is SIDS is not suffocation, but SIDS is different from suffocation, even though it's different. All the measures that we use for SIDS risk reduction also help prevent accidental deaths, such as positional asphyxia overlay and entrapment. And we know that these deaths are 100% preventable. So as we try to reduce the risk of those preventable deaths, we are also reducing the number of SIDS deaths. Okay, this is a picture of a pristine sleep environment. Well, it was up until a little while ago. It does have a drop site on the crib, so we're going to have to redo this slide. We got it from Tomorrow's Child. But it will be done over again, so don't even look at the drop site. But the safest place, as we all know, is the baby in a crib with nothing in the sleep area, the baby's face uncovered, no smoking around the baby, no overheating or overdressing, a firm mattress, and, of course, the baby should always sleep on its back. These are some pictures that we reenactments that we did at the beginning of our program to show people exactly where babies were being found in unsafe sleeping environments. They didn't have to be in a crib, in an adult bed with a family or member, but many of them were found on their tummies in soft sleep, in soft bedding. Okay, these are some other pictures of unsafe sleep environments. Okay, so with all of this information behind us, we decided to begin our Cribs for Kids program on a national level and start giving our materials to family, to organizations throughout the country who wanted to start a program. The program consists of standardized materials. We've been getting a lot of questions about the Safe Sleep video that Dr. Goodstein mentioned. We have them available on our website, cribsforkids.org. Along with all of the materials. We have national fundraising initiatives set up that we're happy to share with any organization that becomes a Cribs for Kids partner and wants to raise money to supply cribs to their communities. We have a crib distribution system set up that assures that when you order the cribs, the Graco Pack and Play from us, they arrive to you within a couple days. Networking opportunities such as conferences and ongoing support through our program. Two of our major sponsors for the program are Graco Children's Products and Pet Ohio Express. In January of 2006, Cribs for Kids was made the exclusive commercial distributor of the Graco Pack and Play. We started to purchase the Pack and Play from Graco in quantities that assured us that we would get the lowest possible price for our partners, and we passed that low price on to our partners. It has our own SKU number so that when you give the crib to a family, they can't take it back to Walmart for store credit. It will be used for its intended purpose to have a baby sleep in it and maybe save its life. Pitt Ohio Express came on board right at the beginning of us becoming a national organization, and they have provided free shipping to all of our partners across the country in the states in which they're shipping to. They also donated a forklift to help with our shipping needs. So as you can see, we have a lot of community support and business support for this very important program. This is a sample of the Graco Pack and Play that we use. We sell it to our partners for $49.99. We chose the Graco unit because Graco invented the play yard type unit, the Pack and Play, about 20 years ago, and has a patent on all the safety features. So we're assured that it's safety approved, it's portable, it's compact, it's easy to assemble for the parent, and most importantly, the parents use the Pack and Play. We designed a sheet that goes with the Pack and Play and fits snugly on the Pack and Play, but it also is an educational piece because it has a safe sleep message. So we sell them to our partners who want to purchase them for their families. Okay, we also supply the Halo Sleep Sack to our families with our Cribs for Kids logo opposite the back to sleep message, and that assures that the mother not only remembers to put the baby on its back to sleep, but to put it in a safe crib. And we use the Respironic pacifier, which is used in many hospitals, for part of our Safe Sleep Survival Kit. We have magnets, and this, as I said, can all be found on our webpage, cribsforkids.org. We have magnets. This is a photo magnet that you can put the baby's picture in and put it on the refrigerator, and we're hoping that that will assure that the mothers will use it and the grandmothers will come in to look at their grandbaby's picture and read the message about safe sleep and not smoking. We have them also in Spanish. Okay, we put all of these items together in what we call the Safe Sleep Survival Kit. So some of our partners buy the whole kit for their families, and that includes the Graco Pack and Play, the Halo Sleep Sack, the sheet with the message on, and the Respironic pacifier, along with all of the federal safe sleep educational materials, the magnet, everything that they need to supply a safe sleeping environment for their infants. We have our videos, Safe Sleep for Your Baby, right from the start, and all the videos that Michael Goodstein mentioned to you are available on our webpage, cribsforkids.org, so you're welcome to go there and order any supplies that you may need. How to become a partner, here again, you go to cribsforkids.org, or you can call me at 412-322-5680, extension 3. But the easiest way is to go to cribsforkids.org and access our application form. You can do it online and submit it, and it will come right to me. Also, there's a trademark license agreement that we ask you to sign, and that gives you permission to use our logo and any of our materials. So that's right along with the application. If you fill both of those out, we will give you a passcode to get into the rest of the website for existing partners that is passcode protected. And in that section, you can upload all of our materials that you'll need to have a successful program. Some of our standardized brochures are available on that same site. There's an educational forum to order all the educational materials that are free from the NIH. We have pre and post tests so that once your program is up and running, you can use them to evaluate it. We have logic models and grant writing materials, including bibliographies and the latest research on safe sleep that you can use to apply for grants, hold harmless agreements, a checklist so that you're sure that you're educating the parents about all of the important tenets of the Back to Sleep and Safe Sleep campaign. And the order forms are there, so everything is there for you to become a Cribs for Kids partner, and there's no cost to becoming a partner. We're welcoming anyone who wants to be a part of this initiative to join us. We were successful last year to have Act 73 of 2010 enacted in Pennsylvania. It's the SIDS Education and Prevention Program, which requires that every mother, before leaving the hospital after giving birth, is given safe sleep information, watches our video, and signs an acknowledgement form. So all of the language for that legislation is on the website, and we're happy to work with any state to try to get that the legislation enacted in their state also. We have networking and ongoing support, and all of this is explained to you on our webpage, cribsforkids.org. And what we know, our motto at Cribs for Kids is knowing is not enough. We must apply. Willing is not enough. We must do. And we hope that you join us in our efforts to save babies' lives. There was a question earlier about whether the webinar was going to be archived, and it will be archived on the childdeathreview.org website and childrensafetynetwork.org. So you'll be able to download all of our slides and our bibliographies and all of our information so that we can help you join our effort to save babies' lives.
Hi, everyone. This is Stephanie Brin closing out. Thank you for participating today, and we want to let you know that we're going to post the answers to your many questions on both websites. That's where the slides and the audio will be archived. So the ChildrenSafetyNetwork.org and ChildDeathReview.org. We want to especially thank Bailey Twiggs and the staff at the Children's Safety Network for making this successful. Again, thanks for your participation. Good afternoon.